learning what the word honor meant to a gladiatrix, and I took those steps in a graveyard. It had been well after the supper hour when we'd arrived, so Telestris escorted us to the kitchens to gather plates of leftovers from the evening's meal that we could eat in our quarters. Coming and going, we saw only a few of the other girls in residence. We spoke to none of them. I was glad of it, mostly because I was beginning to feel a bit ridiculous in the wilted, travel-stained remains of my auction costume. They'd stripped us of most of the finer accessories before loading us into the wagon, leaving me with not much more than the tunica and boots. Elka, for her part, didn't really seem to care. She was far too concerned with balancing the towering heap of meat and cheese and fruit she carried as she walked to really even notice. Our quarters were small, narrow rooms, barely big enough to hold the straw pallet that served as a bed. There was an open, empty trunk at the foot of it for personal belongings. I had none. No talk, no sword, not even a decent set of breeches or a good warm shift made of well-spun wool. Nothing that identified me as Fallon. No tokens or mementos of the life I'd led. The loss of my sister's blade felt like I was missing a limb. And the only thing I had left of Mal was the memory of his kiss and the look on his face in the moment he died. I kicked the lid of the trunk shut and turned my back on it. The single candle on the high windowsill cast dancing shadows on the walls as I finished eating. I was sitting on my bed, too exhausted to even undress and lie down for sleep, when there was a knock on my door. It swung open before I could respond, and I looked over to see a tall, slender girl standing in the doorway. She had short, dense hair cropped close to her skull and dark skin. I tried not to stare, but I had never seen anyone like her before. She ignored my rudeness and simply gestured to the candle.
"Get your boots," she said. "Bring the light. Come with me."
Outside in the hallway, I saw that the girl carried a cloak.
"I am a Jani," she said, holding it out to me. "Put this on."
I took it with a grateful nod, for the night air held a damp chill. "Fallon," I said, and slipped the heavy wool over my shoulders, pulling the hood up around my face. "Where are we going?" The whites of her eyes shone in the darkness.
"To say goodbye."
She turned on silent feet and padded down the corridor. I followed, the candle flame sputtering in the breezes that slipped between the pillars. Ajani led me out into the courtyard at the heart of the Ludus compound, where a gathering of girls and women stood in a cluster, some of them holding torches, all of them cloaked and hooded. If Elka was there, I couldn't tell which of the cloaked figures she was. No one spoke. At the center of the crowd, there was a funeral bier, draped in a gauzy white cloth. And from the shape of it, a body beneath the shroud. Six figures stepped apart from the crowd and approached the bier, lifting it up onto their shoulders as if it weighed no more than a sack of feathers. A procession formed behind them as they moved with stately dignity toward the gates of the Ludus, which was, on that night, open to the world. I fell in behind Ajani and followed. Once outside the Ludus compound, the sky seemed enormous to me. Growing up, I had been so used to being hemmed in by the trees and forests of the Island of the Mighty. But now, I felt small beneath the vast canopy of stars. Mouse small, too small to notice. I slowed my pace, dropping back in the ranks of the gladiatrices, until I trailed behind them. If I could lose myself in a hollow and wait until they were far enough away, perhaps I could make a dash for freedom. And the collar around your neck? How will you outrun that? The cold metal twinged against my skin. I might be just a wee mouse outside those walls, but the slave iron marked me as easy prey for an eagle. Runaway slaves were criminals, punished by flogging or branding, or outright death. I was in the middle of a foreign land, friendless and forsaken. Running, at least running without a plan, would only get me killed. Somewhere over one of the distant hills, a wolf howled, and I quickened my pace to catch up with the others. We walked for a while in silence. In the distance, I could see the dark shapes of other villas, and everywhere we passed, there were lamps burning brightly in all the windows. I was reminded of all the sleepless, sour nights I'd spent growing up in Derovenham, nights when the shades of the unquiet dead walked the earth, and the lamps in all the houses burned until dawn to ward them away. Now, I felt as though I were one of those hungry, roaming shades, torn away from the world, but still tethered to it. We kept walking until a low stone wall with an arched portal appeared in front of us. We passed through, and at first I didn't understand what the place was. On the island of the mighty, we burned our dead or buried them beneath mounds of earth. We did not lock them away in cold little houses made of stone where their spirits would be trapped forever, barred from ever reaching the peace and plenty of the other world. But our procession wound past all those marble tombs, toward an isolated spot beyond. There, I saw another kind of grave, with a log pyre stacked above it. We formed a circle, and those bearing the bier lifted it up and placed it on top of the pyre. In the place where I stood, I was close enough to see that the pit dug in the earth beneath it was filled with shallow baskets bearing all kinds of food. Meat and bread, jugs of wine, a wheel of cheese, and other baskets that held personal belongings. A mirror and an ivory comb, neatly folded clothing, weapons, a lot of weapons. I counted three swords, a pair of spears, a small round shield, and a belt adorned with throwing knives. An impressive collection. But there was one last item to be added to the grave hoard, it seemed. The woman who'd led the procession, the Lady Akalia, I assumed, stood at the head of the grave pit, her face hidden in the depths of her deep hood. She reached beneath the folds of her cloak and brought forth a lamp, a delicate thing hanging on a slender chain. "To light your way in the darkness," I heard her murmur. She let the chain slide through her fingers, and the lantern dropped gently into the pit on top of the other things. Then she raised her voice and said, "Her name was Ismirne. Let it be known. She was a sister of our familia, a gladiatrix of House Akalia. She fought as we fight, with bravery and with skill. 5 days ago, she fought to win honor in a match with a warrior maid of the House Amazona. She won, but Ismirne was grievously wounded in that fight. Our surgeons did what they could for her. Last night, the goddess Nemesis, she of the midnight brow in her great wisdom, called Ismirne to the realm of heroes and sent forth Mercury to guide her there. She feasts now in the halls of Dees. She spars with Minerva, and she waits for all of us to join her there. And we mourn her absence, even as others have this very day joined our ranks here." I swallowed the knot in my throat. She was talking about Elka and me, but I swore in that moment that I would never wind up in this graveyard like this girl, burned and buried in soil, far away from home. "So it goes," the Lannista continued, and something about the way she spoke teased half-forgotten memories from the back of my mind. "The circle of glory, the river of blood, mourn her, gladiatrices. Celebrate her, make her proud." There were sounds of weeping coming from some of the hoods that hid the faces of the girls, and even the Lannister's voice quavered with emotion. But I thought I heard one girl to my left scoff in quiet derision. Had there been a rivalry within the sacred sisterhood of the Ludus? Perhaps sisterhood at the Ludus, as in life, could be a double-edged sword. One of the gladiatrices stepped forward with a torch and thrust it in between the logs of the pyre. The white shroud caught fire instantly, and the sudden updraft of heat sent it fluttering into the sky above our heads, like the spirit of the dead girl released from her body. It hovered there, fluttering for a moment, then burst into a ball of brief flame before raining back down as ash upon us. I thought of how we'd never had the chance to burn Sorsha's body. The Romans had never given her back to us. Then I thought of Mal. I didn't even know where they had buried him. If I had been there, I would have made my father raise a barrow for him in the Forgotten Vale and crown it with a standing stone. Then I would have lain down and wept until the grass upon it grew long, watered with my tears. Through the shimmering air, I looked on the face of the girl who had been called Ismene. She looked like she was sleeping. I searched my heart for a prayer to offer, but I did not know the gods the Lannister had spoken of. I only knew my own. So I formed a silent prayer for the dead girl I'd never known, but in that moment felt a strange kinship with. "May the Morrigan keep your soul," I whispered in my mind. "Yours and Sorsha's and Mal's." As I hoped, one day, she would keep mine. Chapter 15.
"By the Morrigan's bloody teeth," I spat as I stumbled forward, dropping painfully to one knee in the sand of the Ludus practice yard. The wooden sword in my hand was wrenched from my grip, tangled in the hemp net that my opponent wielded. "This isn't fair." The other girl heard me and laughed. Of course it was unfair. After the long journey through Gaul, my muscles had gone soft from lack of decent food and exercise. I had all the strength of a runty kitten, with clumsy fingers and, yes, damn Caius Varro's eyes, weak wrists. And none of that seemed to matter to the girl who stood waiting for me to stand up so she could knock me down again. Her name was Mariel, and she fought, so I'd been told, in the style of a Retiarius class gladiator, wielding strange weapons, a three-pronged spear called a trident, and a woven rope net, like she was dancing with them. She was my first sparring partner of the day. I was beginning to think she might be my last. Mariel's pale skin was freckled where it wasn't covered in the thin blue lines of tattoos, and her dark red hair was tied up on top of her head in an unruly rat's nest of twists and plaits. Her eyes looked upon me with a leaden gleam of cold grey rain. I knew her look. She was from Prydain. Home. Only she was from the far northern reaches, where the tribes were brutal and barbaric, and, as a rule, very good at killing things. So am I. Never mind that the only things I'd ever actually killed up to that point had ended up in the cauldron for supper. With a grunt of effort, I pushed myself back up to my feet.
"Well, come on then, Gladiolus,"
Mariel sneered in barely understandable Latin buried beneath a guttural accent. Gladiolus, I'd learned, was a nickname bestowed on all the new recruits, a pun meant to diminish us by calling us flowers. Pretty to look at, but easily trampled.
"Come on," Mariel barked at me again. "Show us why you are worth all the monies."
She rubbed the fingers and thumb of one hand together.
"So many sestercii. And for what? Falling down?"
Word of the price paid for Elka and me had obviously gotten around. It wasn't my fault someone paid that much for me, I thought bitterly. Behind Mariel, I saw that a group of the other Ludus girls had gathered and were watching us. They were all laughing, except for the one with long black braids who just watched. Her name was Nyx. I'd seen her sparring on several occasions, and she'd impressed me with her technique. I, on the other hand, was clearly impressing no one. I'd figured out fairly quickly that you could tell how well and how often some of the girls had fought by how they were kitted out. The ones who'd earned a purse or two, or more, wore bronze or leather wrist braces or belts, or they had better weapons beyond the Ludus supplied gear. Nyx, by the look of her, was one of the better fighters. She wore tooled leather shin greaves and wrist braces, and a belt around her waist that was decorated with bronze medallions and coral studs. I was dressed in a simple tunic provided by the Ludus, an ugly, shapeless thing stitched of undyed linen and belted with a plain leather belt. It was indistinguishable from the ones Elka and the other new arrivals wore, and distinguishing oneself, I soon learned, was at least as important in the arena as winning. Mariel made an exaggerated show of waiting patiently as I retrieved my weapon and held it at the ready again. The wooden blade trembled only a little in my hand, but the small round wicker practice shield strapped to my left wrist felt heavy as iron as I lifted it into position. Mariel circled to my left, threatening with her trident, the net held down by her side. I'd never fought against such weapons before, and I thought they were ridiculous, more suited to a fishing skiff than an arena. I didn't know how to defend against them. Maybe I didn't have to. Why defend when all I had to do was attack? My sister Sorsha's voice echoed in my mind. Weapon or target? Choose, Fallon. Weapon. With a snarl, I ducked low beneath the whistling swipe of Mariel's trident and, with a distinctly undefensive move, batted it from her fist with the edge of my shield. The tactic would have left me wide open for a thrust, except that her spear was tumbling through the air and landed far from her reach. Now I have a weapon, and she doesn't. Wrong. The net in her other hand whipped forward like a living extension of her arm. The lead weights at its corners stung painfully as the thing tangled around my legs, and I went down in a heap for a second time. I was angry enough to beat Mariel. I just wasn't strong enough. She snorted. You'll never win a bout the way you fight. I bit back a retort and kicked at the hemp snare. At least you bruise pretty colors, Gladiolus, Mariel said, snapping the net out from under me with a flick of her wrist, leaving stripes of angry purple welts on my legs. That ought to get the crowd's attention, assuming you ever make it to a real arena. She grinned and bent down to pick up her trident and, slinging it over her shoulder, walked away, whistling. A crowd of other girls broke up and went back to their own practice, all except Nyx. In the short time I'd been at the Ludus Acalia, I'd noticed that she seemed to be the nominal leader among a group of the Academy's veteran students. Veterans like Mariel. We were of a similar age, I reckoned, and from what I'd heard in passing, I knew Nyx had been virtually raised at the Academy from the time she was 9 years old, an orphan of Greek peasants killed in a tribal raid. As one of the senior gladiatrices, she often acted as a kind of lieutenant to Delestris, drawing up sparring partner lists and scheduling drills, and so far on her watch, I'd faced off against most of the Academy's toughest fighters, even in my less than optimal condition. By comparison, the other girls who'd arrived only a few weeks earlier than me hadn't even really started sparring yet. They were still doing basic strength and agility drills, facing off mostly against practice dummies. It was either a testament to my obvious, if rusty, skills, or an attempt to cull the weakest member of the herd. Nyx leaned against a practice post, arms crossed, watching me as I climbed wearily to my feet. Her expression was unreadable. I couldn't tell if she was mocking me or not, but I decided to find out. I took a step toward her, but Telestris appeared in that moment, stalking back and forth across the yard with her wooden staff in hand, and I wasn't about to bring that kind of trouble down on my head. Nyx had an ally in Telestris, and one of the first things I'd developed on arrival at the Ludus Acalia was a healthy respect for its chief fight mistress. The girls of the Ludus Acalia had paired off again and returned to sparring. I watched them for a moment, all so different and yet each one the same, each one striving to be the shining star in the arena. and I knew I'd been right when I'd first suspected that the Ludus sisterhood might be a treacherous sea to navigate. Mariel, with her sea god's trident, was a painful reminder of that. Back in Derovenum, I'd had the luxury of choosing whom I fought against, but that was clearly no longer an option. I headed toward the weapons storage building so that I could maybe find a throwing spear or a bow to practice solo with. But I knew that eventually I was either going to have to face my fellow Ludus mates head on or curl up like a hedgehog and let them kick me around the pitch. Weapon or target, my sister always said. I felt the small hairs at the nape of my neck prickle, and I suddenly remembered something else Saoirse often said.
Never let down your guard until you're off the field of battle.
Whether it was instinct, luck, or the Morrigan whispering a warning, I twisted sharply to one side just as the throwing knife spun past my ear. The point of the blade stuck in the scarred face of the wooden target 10 paces in front of me. I didn't turn to see who'd thrown it. I just kept walking and, as I passed the target, reached out and yanked the still quivering dagger from the wood. A thin line of crimson marred its edge, and I felt the sear from where it had kissed the side of my neck. I wiped the blood off on the hem of my tunic and thrust the knife into my belt. I had just acquired my first new possession. That evening, I decided a good long soak was in order to soothe the bruises and muscle knots, and I shuffled wearily over to the bathhouse. The lateness of the hour meant that the only other occupants were Elka, whom I met in the dressing foyer, and Ajani, lounging on a bench in the steam of the caldarium. I'd found myself watching the Nubian girl practice her archery in between my own training bouts, impressed by her sharp-eyed aim and dexterity, and her quiet confidence. Ajani was no show-off, even if she had every right to be. I hung up my tunic on a hook and padded over to the hot pool, sinking up to my chin with a sigh that was almost a groan.
You missed all the fun today, little fox, Elka said as she sank down beside me and tipped her head back into the steaming water.
Fun? I shook my head to get the water out of one ear. When did this so-called fun happen?
Just after you were finished getting pummeled all over the practice pitch by Mariel.
Elka grinned.
You left, and Nix had a few unkind things to say about your abilities in your absence.
I shrugged. She probably had a point. I was terrible today.
The only point she has, Elka said, is the thorn she's had stuck up her ass about you ever since we first got here. The gods alone know why. It's not as if we're the only new recruits. Anyway, I guess I just got sick of her casting an evil eye at you everywhere you went.
I sat up, blinking away the spangles left by the steam on my eyelashes.
What did you do?
I demanded. Her eyes widened with mock innocence. I simply asked when Nix was going to call off Mariel and her other attack dogs and muster up enough guts to fight you herself.
Elka stretched her arms above her head and knit her fingers together with a sigh of satisfaction.
Oh, dear goddess, I groaned.
You didn't.
She did.
The surface of the water rippled, and I turned, peering through the steam, to see that Ajani had slipped into the pool to join us, an amused gleam in her wide, dark eyes.
She also said that once you had finished fighting all of Nix's lackeys, you'd be more than happy to explain to her personally all the ways she holds a blade wrong.
Elka, I gaped at her.
Well, she does, Elka rolled her eyes. She hooks her thumb over the crossguard, which we both know is the best way to lose a thumb. And she's all white knuckles, brutish grip, no finesse.
Nix didn't take the criticism very well.
Ajani's lilting accent gave her precise Latin a musical quality.
started screaming in Greek about clawing Elka's eyes out and feeding them to the stable dogs.
Was that what she said?
Elka asked. I'm not up on my Greek.
You didn't have to do that, I said. I can fight my own battles.
I know, she grinned. Only, you didn't even seem to know you had one brewing.
Besides, she continued, someone had to liven things up around here. All we do is eat, sleep, and whack, whack, whack with wooden swords on wooden posts. At least now, we've got something to keep us on our toes.
That much is for certain.
Ajani propped her elbows up on the mosaic-tiled edge of the pool and grew serious for a moment.
Elka may have actually done you a favor, Fallon. I've seen this kind of thing happen here before. Better to lance the boil before the infection grows too deep. Still, you should be careful. Both of you.
I swam over to the edge of the pool and hoisted myself out of the water. I'm going to bed, I said, plucking a towel from a cubbyhole in the wall. Please try not to win me any more mortal enemies before tomorrow.
Elka saluted me with a grin and sank beneath the surface of the lavender-scented pool. I dried off and dressed and walked out into the darkness. The Ludus guards were somewhere making their rounds, but I didn't run across any of them. Instead, it seemed as though the academy grounds were utterly deserted. And yet, all the way back to the barracks wing, I could not ignore the feeling that I was being watched. The sensation set my nerves jangling. I crossed the courtyard where the moonlight-limbed figure of the goddess Minerva gazed dispassionately down at me. In the darkness, I almost didn't notice the dead crow lying at the statue's feet. But when I got to my room, I definitely noticed the single black feather resting on my pillow. It was stained with blood.
Chapter 16.
Gladiolus!
The mocking epithet rang out across the practice ground, and I groaned, knowing it was most likely directed at me. Again. I glanced up from stretching out my calf muscles to see Nyx crossing the sand, her long dark braid swinging behind her, and Thelestris's wooden staff slung carelessly over her shoulder. My guts knotted in apprehension. That morning, Elka had scoffed when I told her of the crow and the feather, and said I shouldn't worry about a silly attempt to spook me. But I could tell that she was amused by the prospect of stirring up a little trouble among the other gladiatrices, whose ranks we would soon officially join, if we survived the training.
Gladiolus, Nyx shouted again, you, the skinny Celt.
I gritted my teeth, decent food, a bed that wasn't the floor of a cage, and an overabundance of exercise had begun to restore my body after the rigors of the slave train. But I still had a long way to go before my strength and reflexes were back to where they should have been.
Today, you'll spar with...
Nyx's gaze roamed over the ranks of the other students.
Gratia.
I swore under my breath. Here, I thought, was my payment for Elka's mischief. Gratia was an ox-necked thing who didn't speak so much as she just grunted, and she handled her wooden gladius, the practice weapon meant to approximate a Roman short sword, like a stone mallet. Nyx grinned coldly at my reaction and gave me a sharp nudge with the end of her staff.
Get going, Gladiolus, she said. The day is wasting away.
I endured a round of thoroughly crushing sparring with Gratia. And after all the other girls had retired to either the dining hall or the baths, slunk off to a corner of the stable yards to sit under the noon sun and massage my aching shoulders. I sat there staring dully at the ground and watching my shadow creep out along the ground past the edges of my toes. Gratia fought in the style of the Marmillo gladiators, with sword and heavy shield. It suited her physique and her penchant for thoughtless brutality, and made her something of a force to be reckoned with in the arena. it also compensated for her utter lack of personality. And that was something that the masters of the Ludi, the gladiatorial games, coveted above all else. Flair. The Ludus fight instructors drilled that into us almost as much as weapons technique. Winning a fight was one thing, winning the crowd was another. But I had yet to even settle on a particular style. Most of the new girls had already begun to discover their natural inclinations toward one style of fighting over another. Me, the sword and round shield were as familiar to me as walking, but the majority of the other gladiatrices fought that way. I'd never distinguished myself with such common methods. I could shoot a bow and drive a chariot, and I certainly threw a spear well enough, and I sincerely doubted whether any of the girls at the Ludus could even come close to executing the Morrigan's flight, even Nyx. The fleeting remembrance of that morning back in the Vale triggered a wave of emotions that swept over me. I had done it, and Mal had seen me do it. Malgun Ironhand. Lethal and beautiful. Every move, every cut and thrust, slash and block and feint, had been for him. Like dancing, as if Mal had heard music no one else could. Sometimes, when I'd watched him practice with his blades, I almost thought that I could hear it too. That music had been silent since the night he died. On a bench near the stables, there was a sack of short wooden staves that had been roughly carved to uniform lengths, and now sat waiting to be turned into practice weapons. I walked over and picked up two that looked to be of equal balance. They needed shaping, sanding, and polishing, and leather wrapped around their hilts. But, for my purposes, they'd do nicely. I looked around to see if there was anyone to watch me. There wasn't. The only other creature in sight was the sway-backed donkey that stood placidly munching at a hay manger. I gave him a sideways look and vowed in that moment I would learn, and not only learn, but master the gladiatorial style of the Dima Kairus, the double sword-wielding warrior who fought with a blade in each hand. Mal had been the Kantii equivalent of a Dima Kairus, an absolute genius with two blades. Growing up, he had developed a series of drills for himself. For 2 years, he'd tried to get me to fight two-handed with him, but I'd been happy with my sword and shield and spear. And the other young Kantii warriors soon tired of getting themselves beaten black and blue fighting against him. So, mostly, he fought the weathered stump of an ancient, lightning-blasted oak. Mal used it as a practice post, and the old forest guardian bore the scars of its encounters with his blades graciously. I thought about all the times I'd sat in the grass watching him practice and wondered if I could reproduce those patterns from memory. There was only one way to find out. I walked over to the stable post and took up a ready stance in front of it. I closed my eyes for a moment and remembered the rhythms, the sounds of the patterns of Mal's drills. Then, slowly, tentatively, I began to emulate them. At first, I was clumsy, awkward, and then, gradually, less so. I could feel the heat of the sun moving across my back, shifting from one shoulder to the other before the clack, clack, clack of my swords against the stable post began to sound like something other than a demented woodpecker. I don't know how much longer it was before I fell so deeply into the patterns that I closed my eyes and the rhythm didn't break or even slow down. Left high, left side, right low, right side, left low, right side, right high, right side, sweep and switch. The patterns changed and became more complex as I practiced. I felt, for the first time since the morning of the Lunasa feast, as if Mal were right there, close enough for me to reach out and touch. I almost felt as if his spirit guided my blades for real. But when the heat of the sun on my left shoulder went cold, blotted out by a shadow, my eyes snapped open. I saw the silhouette of a crested helmet on the barn wall in front of me. Without thinking, I spun around, both wooden blades slashing horizontally through the air.
Hi!
Decurion Caius Varro yelped, leaping back to avoid the blows. My momentum carried me forward, and suddenly, as if released from a spell that had kept me mesmerized as I'd practiced, I felt the full weight of exhaustion hit me. I staggered a few steps toward the Decurion, who put out a hand to stop me from falling on my face. "Tell me," he said after a moment, "are you going to get tired of attacking me anytime soon?" I glared at him, silent except for the breath heaving in and out of my lungs. "Working on that wrist strength, I see." "What are you doing here?" I panted. His lip twitched with amusement. "I was watching you," he said. "It was quite entertaining and enlightening. I'm not sure what grudge you bear that poor stable post, but it's obvious you have some real talent and some training."
"Some," I agreed dryly.
He nodded. "But you're clutching your weapons too tightly. You're sacrificing accuracy and fluidity for brute force." I rolled my eyes and brushed past him so I could return the wooden blanks I'd been using to the pile for finishing. But when I looked down at them, I saw that they were ruined, with the unpolished edges dented and hewed to splinters. I threw them into the basket of scrap wood beneath the table. It was possible the Decurion had a point, but I certainly wasn't going to tell him that. I sat down on the bench beside the table and kneaded at the burning in my neck muscles with tingling fingers. After a moment, I realized that the Decurion was still standing there watching me. There was a look of curiosity, or maybe it was uncertainty on his face. "What are you really doing here, Decurion?" I asked. He sat down on the other end of the bench and clawed at the chin strap of his helmet, lifting it off his head. His hair was damp with sweat from the day's hot sun and plastered to his scalp until he scrubbed his palm briskly over his head to make it bristle. "Officially," he shrugged, "I'm running errands on behalf of Caesar to his Lannister."
"And unofficially?"
"Satisfying my curiosity? Or trying to?" He glanced over at me and paused for a moment, as if trying to decide whether or not to continue. Then he asked, "What does a mark in the shape of a knotted triple raven mean to you?" My breath stopped in my throat, and everything around me seemed to get very quiet. Even the singing of the birds in the trees died to silence. And in that stillness, I could hear the Morrigan's throaty dream voice whisper my name. Was she telling me to trust him? Or was she trying to warn me?
"Why do you ask?"
"Why don't you tell me?" he countered. "If your expression is any indication, it clearly means something."
Of course it meant something. It was the symbol of my goddess and the brand that had marked my blade. I had no idea why he was asking, but even the way he posed the question made me cautious. I didn't know how to answer, and so instead I just stared at the donkey, which stared back. No help at all.
"All right," the Decurion sighed. "Let me tell you a little story." I eyed him warily and stayed silent, listening. "The slave auctions are almost always an entertaining bit of distraction for the good citizens of Rome," he continued. "And never more so than when Charon comes to town to market his wares. He's theatrical, certainly. Shows every piece of..." He bit off his words abruptly. "That is, he shows every, person off to their best potential. Costumes, cosmetics, wigs, the works. As I'm sure you noticed. But your mock jewel? That was extravagant, even for him."
"It was hardly a mock jewel," I said. "A man died. I don't think Charon was expecting that."
"No. But he also thought it worth the risk. The high price he got for you bore that out. And that's what was so surprising about the whole affair."
The corner of the Decurion's mouth lifted.
"Truthfully, sparkling costumes and a dead Elysian notwithstanding, there was nothing particularly extraordinary about your performance that day."
I sputtered in outrage, but he was right.
Even that day's kill had belonged to Elka, not me. Pontius Aquila, started off with a high enough bid, he continued. But then, in the interval, while they cleared away the corpse, Charon sends me into the crowd with a message for the Lady Aquileia.
What message?
A trunk. He watched for my reaction. With a sword in it. A sword with a triple raven etched upon the blade. My mind flashed back to the chaos of the slave galley, sinking beneath me as I helped Charon heave his trunk over onto the other ship. Was that what had been so vitally important to him? My sword. Aquileia offers a sky-high price, well beyond the means of the other bidders. And that seals the deal right there. For a pair of unknown, unqualified, potential gladiatrixes. The Decurion's clear hazel gaze bored into me, unblinking. So tell me, what am I missing? I'm flattered you think so very highly of me. He ignored my sarcasm. It's your sword, isn't it? He asked. How did a lowly thrall come by a blade like that? I shot to my feet. How dare you assume I was always a lowly thrall? He grinned, a wily expression, and said, So, I was right. He leaned forward on the bench, as if to get a closer look at me. I guessed as much after we spoke at Massilia, and I said you didn't talk like a slave. You're freeborn, aren't you? Of course I'm freeborn, I snapped. I'm the daughter of a king. My words hung in the air between us. For a moment, I thought he might scoff at me for making such an unbelievable claim. But instead, his gaze darkened, and his grin disappeared. Surely you're joking, he asked. What if I am? What do you care if I'm a queen in my own land, or a cowherd? Because you're not in your own land anymore, he said. This is Rome. Treachery and opportunism and backstabbing run in her veins like lifeblood. And if you've never had to live your life constantly looking over your shoulder, then you have no idea how dangerous it can be. The Lady Aquileia is a close friend of Caesar's, and when Caesar isn't off in other lands making war, he's here in Rome making enemies. It's my job to make sure those enemies can't use the few friends he has against him.
What has any of this to do with me?
I don't know. Yet. But the mark on that blade clearly meant something to the Lannister, and Charon knew it would. I'd like to know what that something is.
Then you'll have to ask them, I said. All I know is that it's a symbol of my goddess, sacred to the warriors of my tribe. There is power in the mark. Perhaps the Lannister recognize that.
I suppose that's true, he said, frowning in thought. Your people aren't the only ones who think of ravens as omens, although most Romans would consider them bad ones. I thought about the dead bird and the bloody feather someone had left in my room. I'd thought it was just a prank at the time, but now I wondered if I shouldn't tell the Decurion about it. I knew more than he did just how powerful a symbol the raven was, and how dangerous. But no. How could there possibly be a connection between my sword and the feather? And at any rate, the crimson plume of the Decurion's very Roman helmet stirred in the breeze and reminded me that he belonged to the legions that had invaded my home. He was the enemy of my people. He was not my friend. If the Lannister thinks you're worth keeping out of Pontius Aquila's collection, then you're worth keeping safe. The Decurion continued. The Ludus Aquileia is Caesar's, remember? He owns it, and everything and everyone in it. And it's worth a lot of money. And as much as some people might think the gladiatorial games are nothing more than a decadent indulgence to keep the mob distracted and mollified, there's more to it than that. There are rivalries that run generations old and deep. Divides both politically and philosophically among the Republic's elite. There are those in the Senate who whisper of Caesar's increasing power, of his superior heirs. They say he's been tainted by the Egyptian queen, Cleopatra. that she's convinced him he should be treated as a god, not a man. An emperor, rather than Rome's chief consul. So, I still don't understand what any of this has to do with me. Caesar's perceived arrogance has caused a great deal of resentment among his peers in the Senate. But the plebs, the common people, adore him. He looked at me. They love him for just such things as, well, you. Or rather, what you might become in time. Caesar's games are the best. His fighters, the best. His upcoming quadruple triumphs are his gift to the people of Rome, a massive celebration such as this city has never seen. They are meant to cement his popularity in such a way that the Senate will never be able to cast him down, not without risking the wrath of the mob. That's how important Caesar's gladiators are to him. Now do you understand?
I did, or at least I thought I did.
Someone called Caius's name, and he glanced over his shoulder to where another legionnaire approached, leading a pair of horses.
I have to go, he said.
Before you do, I said, tell me this. You could have just asked Charon about the sword mark the next time you saw him. Why did you seek me out instead?
He was silent for a long moment, staring at me, and I wondered if he would give me an answer. Then he said,
I was curious about you.
Why?
On the ship. I saw something in you.
I raised an eyebrow at him.
And that was?
The absolute need to fight, to be free. That's something I can understand.
I wasn't so sure he could.
Some years ago, he continued, there was a revolt. A gang of slaves, gladiators in fact, rose up and challenged the might of the Republic. They fought the legions for a very long time, and they very nearly won. But it took one man, a man named Spartacus, to ignite the spark that turned to flame. I've always admired him, even though he went against everything I'm supposed to fight for as a soldier of Rome. I thought on the ship that I saw that same kind of ember glowing in your eyes. I suppose I wanted to see if it was still there.
I felt a sudden prickling behind my eyes. How could I even hope to keep such a spark alive when it seemed my life was destined to play out behind the high walls of an arena? I blinked the tears away quickly, but not before the Decurion saw. His expression softened.
A gladiatrix, if she's good enough, may one day earn enough in the arena to buy her freedom, you know.
He reached into the basket and pulled out one of the wooden blanks I'd hewed to kindling. He tossed it to me and grinned.
Just be good enough.
My mind reeled with the implications of actually, one day, being able to make enough money to buy my freedom back. No one at the Ludus had told us that yet. Then I remembered just how very much money I'd been sold for. Good enough would have to be very good indeed. The Decurion laughed at my stunned expression.
I'll be back soon on Caesar's business, he said. Perhaps I might look in on your progress.
If it pleases you, Decurion, I said, distracted.
It would.
He hitched his cloak higher on his shoulder.
My curious mind and all. Also, another thing that would please me is if, when it's just the two of us together, I'd like it very much if you would call me Caius instead of Decurion. Or better yet, Kai.
I thought about how very unlikely it was that we'd find ourselves in such circumstances again.
As you wish, Kai.
A moment of silence stretched between us, and then he sighed heavily.
What?
I blinked at him.
That's the part where you're supposed to say, and you can call me.
I hesitated for a moment.
Fallon.
Kai smiled, a slow inward turning smile, like he'd just learned a secret.
Be well, Fallon, he said. Be careful. And tomorrow, try tucking in your chin and imagine breathing all the way down your arms, right out the ends of your fingertips, and into your swords. Let go. Relax into the work instead of fighting through it. Shaking my head, I watched him mount his horse and ride off in a haze of dust. Sound advice, maybe. But it seemed to me that there was far too much fighting ahead for me to ever think about letting go.
Chapter 17. The day of our gladiatorial oath swearing approached with the swiftness of a late summer tempest, and just as much foreboding. For weeks it had seemed nothing more than a distant threat, an occasional rumble like thunder on the horizon. But now, the very air of the Ludus training grounds seemed to bristle with the furious, pent-up energy of a storm cloud ready to burst. Telestrius and the other Fightmasters, two hard-bitten ex-Legion soldiers named Kronos and Titus, had been observing our progress with eagle-keen eyes, and the tension among the girls was palpable. I know I felt like a walking bundle of flayed nerves, both on the pitch and off. Just because the Ludus had bought us as slaves didn't mean they couldn't sell us again if we didn't measure up as potential gladiatrices. As much as I loathe the idea of living under the yoke of the Ludus, performing like a trained animal for the delight of bloodlusting crowds, the prospect of getting dragged back to the auction block to be sold as a failed fighter was far more odious and, truthfully, terrifying. At the same time, what Kai had told me that day by the stables had kindled in me a tiny spark of hope. If I could become a gladiatrix, there was a chance. A faint hope, maybe, but still. That I could one day earn my freedom with my sword. Just be good enough, he'd said. So I fought with the Mariels and the Gratias of the academy, and I even sparred with Nyx at Telestris's cruel behest. One miserable raining afternoon in a bout that lasted forever and saw us both end up covered in mud and bruises. I bit down on the urge to whimper every morning from the ache in my muscles, and I spent every spare second I had hacking away at the stable post with my two practice swords under the disinterested gaze of the donkey. I worked on my presentation, on flourishes and salutes to the, as yet imaginary, crowds of onlookers, and on my style. Some of the girls who'd fought in the arenas already had patrons who sponsored them, wealthy patricians who flaunted their riches by equipping their favorite fighters in the games with better weapons and fancier armor. Me, I spent the hours I wasn't practicing or sleeping digging through the baskets of scrap leather in the weapons makers' shops, fashioning wrist braces and a pair of shin guards for myself. I incised the spiral patterns of the Cantii on them with the point of my dagger. They weren't anywhere near as fancy as some of the bronze ones the other girls wore. But they were something. A start. They'd have to suffice until I could attract a patron of my own. By barely measurable increments, the days became less grueling. And through it all, Elka was there to lift my spirits with her blunt humor and fierce friendship. As much as I hoped that I would make it all the way to the oath ceremony, I hoped just as fervently that she would too.
You're getting good, little fox, Elka said as she ambled over, wiping the sweat from her tall brow with the back of one arm. You could almost pass for a Verini, the way you fight.
I grinned at her. And you could almost pass for a Cantii. I nodded at the spear she held in one fist. She'd been practicing her throwing all morning, and she had a sharp eye. Only we throw our spears from the decks of racing chariots.
Chariots are for girls, she laughed and nodded toward the gate in the compound wall that opened out toward the shores of Lake Sabatinus.
That day the gate stood wide, and we could see a pair of the swift, light war carts racing along the strand. Mounted Ludus guards rode nearby, keeping the charioteers under watchful eyes, but I envied them even that illusion of freedom. The drivers were Nyx and another girl whose name I didn't know. Nyx lashed furiously at her ponies and pulled ahead of the other chariot with a triumphant shout. The wing of black hair flowing out behind her reminded me of the crow feather that had been left in my room. I'd cleaned the dry blood off the thing and put it under my pillow. I slept with it there as a kind of secret act of defiance. Crows and ravens were sacred to the Morrigan, and I didn't think she'd take kindly to one of her own being gutted for the purposes of a prank. Every now and then I wondered if I'd been foolish not to report the incident to Telestris or one of the other masters. But I didn't want anyone to think I couldn't fight my own battles. Not before the oath swearing. And if the dead bird and bloody feather had been meant to frighten me, they'd failed to do so. If anything, they spurred me on. The goddess was on my side. At least that's what I kept telling myself. I didn't know who'd left the thing or why. I might have suspected Nyx, but that's all it was, a suspicion. And she hadn't followed up with any similar threats. Still, I frowned as I watched her race down the lakeshore, urging her horses on with the crack of her whip. A shadow of unease crept across what had been my good mood. Elka nudged me with her elbow. Come on, she said. I was joking. Here, help me practice. She led me over to the far side of the yard, where there was an assortment of targets set up. One of them was made from an old round shield pinned to a post through its center. It had been painted like the spokes of a wheel, divided into numbered sections, 1 to 12. Kronos the trainer had explained to me what the number markings meant and how to read them, but I still got confused sometimes and mixed them up. So, we made a joke out of it every